Well, the people in the town office, and the whole nine yards were all disturbed because, like any dead body, it began to smell, you know, it stinked the town. A lot of people were saying, we got to move out of here on account of the odor from this whale, see?
You could smell it. Low tide smells around here anyways, but this reeked of death.
Rotten meat, sitting in the sun for a month. You just take the cover off the can, stick your head in there, and that's just about what it smelled like.
It was a oily, greasy smell.
It was right in your nose.
Oh, it smelled like rotten meat.
Rotten fish and oil.
The odor, they couldn't stand it. You know, when the wind was blowing that direction right on the town.
You could smell it from miles away.
As far away as Eastport, Maine, they could smell it.
Oh, I touched it. Probably felt the same as what it did almost when it was alive, cold. They're cold-blooded.
And it did have a funny feeling. The texture of the animal was...
a great big smooth piece of rubber.
I touched it with one finger, and I had to use less oil to get
the stench really hard to get off your hands.
I put hand cleaner on my hands. I put straight gasoline.
You have to wind up bleaching it off your hands, and that's what I wound up doing.
And finally they decided something had to be done about it.
It would come to the point where no matter what it cost, it had to go.
They knew something had to be done.
It had to be done.
And they did something.
One thing led to another, so they called Ramsel, a man named Ramsel.
I was notified by the town of Lubac. They contacted me to come down and dig a hole with that excavator. It was kind of a hazy, overcast day, and the sun didn't shine. I think there was like a crowd of 15 or 20 people actually showed up.
There were a lot of people, maybe 100. Hundreds of people.
Word spread fast. Everybody in town was there. But I just wondered where are they all going, you know. So I went too.
So we dug a hole as close as we could. And before I got the hole dug, he accidentally slid on his own and went into the hole.
Sort of graceful. I mean, it was so big, it just took its time. Just sort of the side caved in a little bit.
He rolled in, he slipped in and rolled up, belly up.
When they finally rolled it into the hole, you know, everybody sort of quieted down. And they were kind of respectful. They're kind of sad to see it go.
Oh, I don't know how to explain it. Something that you never think of, dying. You always hear stories that a whale is a passed on fisherman's soul.
Made me think how small I was. Yeah. There's a lot of people that think, oh, I'm so big. I'm so great. No matter how powerful they are, something will happen in life that will cause people to say, how small am I anyway?
We're both mammals who have reached the pinnacle of our place, and they just seem to be close to us. I feel close to whales.
And we buried it 6 feet over the top of it.
Dug up gravel and stuff and covered it all over.
And I've dug grave, you know, for humans here in color also. So it just seemed different to bury something with no box. Just putting raw earth right back onto his body.
You picture him as being immortal, like a free soul, free will out there. You just don't see him dying. It was sad. It was very sad.
And it took about 2.5 hours, 3 hours to dig the hole. And then fill it back in. And by noon time, it was all finished. I think I got like $300 to bury this thing. I'd done the town a favor, actually. Maybe the whale, too. How do we know?
It was just a day's work for me to help bury a whale. I mean, it was an oddity that to bury
it's
a
just
whale.
Just something weird that had happened and something unforetold. And
if you never did see it, you couldn't understand it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, as far as I know, it's still there.
He's still laying there. That's about all I can tell you about the whale.
I haven't been down there since. Maybe I'll go down and take a stroll over.
That's the way things went. And this is from Mars Allen of Lubac, Maine. Just another fish story.
Just Another Fish Story, produced by Molly Menschel, winner of the 2005 Third Coast Festival's Best New Artist Award. You may not hear another radio story from Molly for a bit. She's traveling the world on a semester at sea. But the good news is she took her tape recorder with her. One of the things radio does best is tell small but important stories that would otherwise be overlooked. But producers Joe Richmond, Sue Johnson, and Ben Shapiro faced the opposite challenge when they tackled one of the biggest stories of the 20th century. Their series, Nelson Mandela, An Audio History, won the Bronze Award at this year's Third Coast Festival. The producers wove the story of the fight against apartheid from over 150 hours of interviews and archival tape. As Joe Richmond describes, they had to find a new way to tell the story of one of the most famous men on the planet.
Before we began, we thought that the main thing we were going to be able to do was just tell the story through sound alone. You know, take out narration, use archival tape, and use interviews as sort of found narration. As we went along, actually, you know, what I found out that although there's been so much coverage of Mandela, the TV video archives were pretty well mined, but the audio-only archives had just been shockingly untouched. And there was so much material there, you know, just so much wonderful tape that could actually play the role of the narrator, that it wasn't until we actually started playing with some of this archival tape that I really felt like, yes, we were going to be able to tell this complicated history through sound alone without a narrator. You know, if I was going to narrate it or going to bring a narrator to come in, it would sound similar to other things and it would be kind of this piece looking back at history. And I wanted it to be more experiential. I wanted the listeners to be able to feel the dust and the scuffing around and the ambience of history.
Well, one key scene that really accomplishes that is the trial of Nelson Mandela and his co-defendants for acts of terrorism and treason. But before we play an excerpt from the proceedings and Mandela's long speech at the trial, why don't you give us the context for the trial and tell us what was at stake?
Well, this was in 1962-63. Mandela actually had already been arrested. And then what happened is the famous Rivonia Farm outside of Johannesburg, where the ANC at that time had sort of set up headquarters, the farm was raided, and a lot of the leaders of the movement at that time were arrested. So here were the leaders of the movement all on trial. So in this next piece of tape, you'll hear Dennis Goldberg, Ahmed Kathrada, George Bezos was the attorney, and Mandela himself.
Good, let's listen.
When the defense case started, Mandela, he was going to be the first defense witness. And the prosecution, Dr. Yuta, had prepared extensively to cross-examine Mandela and break him down. And they all got a shock when our lawyers announced that Mandela will not give evidence, but he'll make a statement from the dock.
The courtroom was absolutely packed. He stood up and he proceeded to deliver the speech.
During my lifetime, I have dedicated my life to this struggle of the African people. And I have...
So it was a four-hour speech. But that last bit where he said, these are the ideas for which I'm prepared to die. Just that last bit.
I knew what he was going to say because we'd all seen the speech. Everybody had made comments about it. And I knew he was going to say, in effect, hang me if you dare to, Mr. Judge. But only when he said it.
I have cherished the idea of a democratic and free society in which all persons will live together in harmony and with equal opportunity. It is an idea for which I hope to live for. But my Lord, if it needs be, it is an idea for which I am prepared to die.
It was terribly moving. Nobody said anything. Even the judge didn't know what to say. I knew it was a moment of history. He emerged then as a great leader.
As you thought. Very well, the court will adjourn.
I remember we adjourned for lunch and a friendly African warder asked me the question, Mandela, what do you think is going to happen to you in this case? I said to him, ah, they are going to hang us. Now, I was really expecting some word of encouragement from him. And I thought he was going to say, ah, man, you see, that can never happen. But he became serious. And then he said, I think you're right, they're going to hang you.
The next day, armed police massed in even greater force as Mr. Justice De Wet was passing sentence.
I am by no means convinced that the motive of the accused were as altruistic as they wish the court to believe.
When they said, stand up for your sentence, we thought, well, here it comes.
The sentence in the case of all the accused will be one of life imprisonment.
As you Lord. Very well, the court will then adjourn.
And we laughed. We turned to each other and laughed. Because we expected to be hanged.
At the back entrance to the Pretoria Court, large crowds gather to watch the accused being driven away to start their life sentences.
Nelson Mandela did become the symbol of the struggle for liberation in South Africa. People could identify with Nelson Mandela. Nelson Mandela the lawyer. Nelson Mandela the hero. Nelson Mandela the handsome man. But it was the response to his Rivonia trial speech, called throughout the world as the I am prepared to die speech, which kind of somersaulted him and the African National Congress and the need to put an end to apartheid into the world consciousness.
As we were being flown to Robben Island, one tried to accept the reality that we may in fact spend years in prison. But we believed very strongly that we would not die in jail. We would return.
There are a number of things that are a revelation, I think, in that scene. But the one that really gets me is the friendly warder or the guard. Because here we've heard Nelson Mandela become an icon of history in the archival tape. And then when the guard turns to him and he's obviously he's looking for compassion and needing comfort, it brings it back home that this man is just human and he is just a human being caught in history. And that is something that I don't think I could grasp from the historical record or reading an article. It's in their voices.
Mandela, you know, for such a charismatic figure, he's actually an incredibly uncharismatic speaker. That tape just sounds to my ear different from so much of the tape I've heard of him. There's a kind of a jokey and relaxed and reflective quality to it that I just love.
This happened over 40 years ago. So what was involved in getting a hold of those audio tapes of the trial?
A lot of those tapes from the Rivonia trial came from SABC, which was for decades the state broadcaster, basically the mouthpiece of apartheid, and is now the public broadcaster of South Africa. And I was able to spend literally just weeks in the basement there just combing through tapes. And the tape of the prosecutor that you hear there had never been broadcast before. And that just, we just stumbled on it, on this old reel-to-reel tape that was just said Rivonia on it, and I put it on. And here was the trial itself. Here was the prosecuting attorney, you know, lay out the charges, and it had all this sort of tape between the lines. You know, you could hear like the cough, which I love. You know, just once you hear like a cough in the courtroom and a little scuffle of feet in the courtroom, all of a sudden you don't have just the words anymore. You have the scene.
So it's a three-dimensionality that you get from such little cues.
I think that's the goal, to make it feel like it is unfolding in front of our ears, even though, of course, it happened 4 decades earlier.
Joe Richmond, executive producer of Mandela and Audio History. It won the Bronze Award at this year's Third Coast Festival. To learn more about the festival and to hear more of the winning entries, check out thirdcoastfestival.org. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is the 2005 Third Coast Festival broadcast. Coming up, the competition's Silver Award winner. The festival is made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation. This broadcast comes to you from Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. This is the 2005 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Barbara Bogave. Our next piece looks at the destructive effect modernization has had on South Africa's neighbor to the north, Botswana. It was produced by sound artist John Wynn for the BBC, and it won the Silver Award at this year's Third Coast Festival. Wynn got the idea for a story about cultural loss from a sound he heard on TV. The sound was the click of Khoisan, one of Africa's endangered click languages. The music he heard in the clicks drove home to him how much the world loses when a language dies out.
On my first trip to Southern Africa, I heard a newsreader reading in Zulu. At first, it seemed like just another foreign language, and then suddenly a pop sort of came out of this newsreader's mouth, and I was just fascinated by this kind of the energy of these miniature explosions in a language. But I started to do research into the languages and the culture and learned that there was a lot more to it than just the beauty and uniqueness of the languages themselves. There are about 6,000 languages in the world now, and by some estimates, somewhere between 50 and 90% of them will be gone in 100 years. We're losing a pretty important part of humanity.
How did the research that you did inform how your story would sound, the soundscape you'd create? Because it is a piece of sound sculpture.
Yeah, all the sounds in the piece are from either the people's languages that I recorded, or I recorded interviews with a couple of academics. And the only sounds that aren't from voices in the piece are sounds from recordings I made in the environment, so along the Trans-Kalahari Highway, and in and around the village of Dakar, where I made most of the recordings.
Let's listen to the beginning of your piece, because it takes a good few minutes before we hear any speech or what you recognize as speech at all. Let's listen to the opening, then we can talk about what you were thinking about.
Interesting things we notice as we go around studying and documenting languages is that all sorts of amazing and unusual characteristics of human language turn up. So one of the perhaps most striking examples of this is amongst the Khoisan languages and some of the Bantu languages that are in contact with them in Southern Africa, that they have an amazing range of click sounds that are used in the languages to express meaning.
The women and children like to go and collect wild berries and edible and succulent roots when there isn't much water available.
They often go out for the whole day. In the wilderness, the small children sometimes get thirsty, and the group must go back home to get water for them. The men go farther to hand, so they go where they know there's water, and they drink from those water points. The women don't go as far together, but where they go, there is no water.
The common language is spoken in Botswana,
There are some very few speakers of Krung in Namibia and in South Africa. He's got five fundamental cliques: the bilabial, which is the, and then the dental, the interdental, the, and then the alveolodental, the, and you've got the palatal and the lateral. A Krung is not written, it's the most difficult, has a clique inventory, talking of the fundamental cliques and their influxes, that is the accompaniment, that number over 120.
I personally feel inferior to somebody who can produce 80 different click sounds.
Quite clearly, these are languages that won't survive beyond the next generation.
Okay, right now I think we're 3 minutes into the program or more. We've heard this panoply of sounds, of buzzing, and I think, what's a truck going by on a highway?
It's a car on the Trans-Kalahari Highway, yeah.
What story do those sounds tell?
Well, the car is passing. I used it as a kind of metaphor for the effect of technology and the encroachment of technologized society into indigenous societies like the Khoisan. The Trans-Kalahari is this sort of diagonal slash across the Kalahari Desert, which takes indigenous people, young people often, away from their local culture and takes them to the city where, of course, their small local languages are not of any use. And the languages that I recorded were five different ones, all of them endangered, somewhere between roughly 1,000 speakers, in some cases up to perhaps 4,000 or 5,000 speakers.
What are the factors in causing them to die out?
Well, there are many. Economic pressures, of course. Young people can see that if they learn English and concentrate on that, or Setswana, which is the national language in Botswana, their chances of getting a job are better. They don't see any value to continuing their language until, of course, then you're left with just a few old speakers who, when they die, the language goes as well.
John Nguyen is the producer of Hearing Voices, which won the Silver Award at the 2005 Third Coast Festival. He recorded this singing in western Botswana. The group is the Bokomoso Preschool Training Project Choir. There's so much music in language, even when we aren't singing. That's something that Steve Wadham's ears are attuned to, and it's provided the inspiration for a lifetime of groundbreaking radio. Wadham's is a longtime producer for the CBC, the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, and he's the recipient of a new honor from the Third Coast Festival this year, the Audio Luminary Award. Steve Wadham's has inspired whole generations of radio artists with his enthusiasm and his belief in the power of radio. It's the power that comes in that collaboration between radio producers and their audience. The producers suggest the images, and listeners give them life.
I believe more and more, as I'm trying to do this radio thing, that if you don't see it in your mind's eye when you're listening to something, you don't really hear it. So my job is to make a picture stream that comes out of the speaker of the radio to the brain of the listener, slap bang in the middle of the forehead, and lodge there for a lifetime. sometimes if my images are explicit, they're probably replicated reasonably accurately in the mind of the listener, but maybe not. You never know. It's a very frustrating and delicious thing.
I know you're a musician. You
sort of, yes.
You're a choral musician.
I do try to sing.
And someone has said in introducing your work that you don't so much produce documentaries as you compose them.
Huh.
What's the difference, and what does music bring to your instincts as a radio producer?
Hearing the cadence of a scene, trying to hear the rise, the fall of even a vocal thing, a spoken word. But it gets deeper and deeper because you can really go to town on the musicality of the voice if you want to.
I've done that in your work.
In the Idea of Canada, we produced this thing about 12 years ago which explicitly set out to explore the musicality of the human voice and work with it.
You look at Canada right now and there are so many things that are unique in Canada. We have our country, which is very vast and it's not overpopulated. Full of nature, and it still could be saved. We have a lot to be proud of as a nation.
We go from one end of the country to the other. We don't see anything in between. We don't even know for sure if it's there. You can't see through the cloud. The space, the skies, the attitudes, the emotions, the very strongly marked seasons, the vastness of this country. It's wondrous.
What radio have you made that you're most proud of in your long career?
Oh, boy. The Change in Farming, a collaboration with young composer Adam Goddard, which is a lovely program. Once in your life, you get lucky and you nail it, and I think we nailed it with that one.
Tell me about that. That's a story about a musician, a composer.
Mm-hmm. Young guy, composer.
It's really the story of his relationship with his grandfather and his grandfather's relationship with the changing times.
Yeah, all the farming, changes in farming he'd seen over the years. He's nearly 90 when this happened. It's a grandson trying to capture the spirit of his grandfather before he dies, really. But being a composer, he hears the music in his grandfather's voice and fools around with it and turns him into a rapper.
I remember when I bought my first combine, corn in the field, it seemed funny. There'd be two of us working, well, taking the place of 15.
I remember
getting into arguments over things.
Some of my friends,
that is the reason higher production has kept the price in the store where it is.
I'll tell you how you're going to reap the benefit where it is.
The store.
And then, and this scene must be in the piece, I mean, we could not broadcast it without the old guy having his say. So, you know, he plays it back.
His hip-hop version.
Yes, the hip-hop grandfather, and the grandfather has his reaction to it, and that has to be in the piece, and it's the final scene, of course.
Now we run out of tape. Hey?
Right. So anyways, that's it.
Now, I don't understand this.
Yeah?
Repeating myself all over.
Yeah.
Why
do I do that?
I don't.
That's a musical thing.
Is it?
Repetition.
Oh.
Yeah. I wanted to pick up some of the character in your voice.
Talk about something I didn't know I had.
Well, you do.
As long as you know what you're doing, that's the main thing.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. I'm just a guinea pig. Right?
Right.
But anyway, we can go out to the barn now, eh?
The Change in Farming, produced by Steve Wadhams with Adam Goddard for the CBC program Out Front, Wadhams is this year's winner of the Audio Luminary Award at the Third Coast Festival. That story exemplifies economy and craft in radio. It condenses the enormous changes that occur over two generations into such a short time, really into just the space of a conversation between a grandfather and his grandson. Steve Wadhams makes it sound easy. But in fact, in radio, time is the tyrant cracking his whip over your head. For instance, now we'll take a 60-second break, and then we'll be back with a story so big, so full of murders, singing maidens, and mad passions, that it could barely fit into an hour. I'm Barbara Bogave, and you're listening to the Third Coast Festival broadcast. The festival is made possible with lead funding from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation. This broadcast comes to you from Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Our next award-winning story had the modest goal of condensing Wagner's The Ring Cycle, the 20-hour opera, into just 60 minutes. And that includes not only its plots and themes, but also the world of its fans, and even its influence on movies and pop culture. The program The Ring and I, The Passion, The Myth, The Mania, received an honorable mention at this year's Third Coast Festival. It was produced for WNYC, New York Public Radio, by Aaron Cohen, Elena Park, and here, Jad Abumrad.
We didn't actually understand the ambition of the project until we were about halfway through.
Which was probably a good thing.
It was a good thing. We might not have done it had we understood what a big thing this was. But at a certain point you think, okay, I'll just describe what it is and then I'll talk about what it means. But the what it is part took forever. Because what it is it's complicated, it's messy, there's so many characters, you don't know who's killing or sleeping with whom, and all of that stuff is very important and you can't dumb it down. And so having the balance of the what it is with the what it means was the real challenge for us.
And as a listener, I don't necessarily care about what it is. That's the thing. And actually,
that was my argument.
Yeah. Was it really?
It was.
We
had a certain obligation because people have religious feelings towards this work. And so we couldn't really get away with just saying, okay, there's this opera, there's a bunch of stuff happens. Now let's really talk about like the cool stuff. We had to actually talk about what it is and cover our bases, so to speak.
Well, are you speaking to then part of the choir, the people who know the cycle, the ring cycle,
so we
or are you speaking
both?
To both? And which are you?
I don't have any love for opera, but I'm really interested in what people see when they watch opera and why it's so moving to them, because the experience of watching an opera is watching two people stand on stage side by side. Sometimes it feels so divorced from any kind of theater that I'm used to. And yet people watch it and they weep and they laugh and they have these spiritual experiences. And I want to just understand that. I want to know. I mean, that was the thing that got me interested in this, was what's the big deal? I think we asked at one point in the documentary, what's the big deal? Like, I really wanted to know. That's a genuine question.
Well, you use a cast of characters to answer that question. Who are these people and why are they so into it? And you return to them, and they're Wagner fans, and they're also experts on opera and Wagner and musicians and composers. And throughout the piece, you return to a shopping trip with a Ring Cycle fan. Why don't we listen to one of these, the first of these scenes?
Fred?
Yes.
Hey.
Hi.
Jad, nice to meet you.
Pleasure to meet you.
Fred Plotkin. He writes about food and opera, and, get this, is on his 38th Ring Cycle.
This year, 2004, I'll be seeing three Ring Cycles in different places. I'm going to two at the Met with different casts, and then I'm going to one in Finland. My idea in creating a menu to dine while watching all four Ring operas is that it be thematic with the Ring and inspired by the Ring. And I decided to look at the cycle and look for gastronomic cues, of which there are so many throughout the Ring cycle, of foods, of food products.
He calls this the Wagner meal cycle. He's able to tell the entire story of the Ring through food, and that's why we're here. For sustenance, A.
I take doggy bags when I attend performances and eat them at the intermissions.
And B, because the plot of the Ring cycle can get complicated fast, and this is an easy way to remember what's happening on stage. So Fred begins how the Ring cycle begins, with gold, which we find at Fairway in the chocolate aisle.
Gianduiotti are essential to the Ring cycle because these are little gold-wrapped nuggets of chocolate. They're like currency, but shaped like bricks of gold.
The first opera, The Rheingold, begins underwater, at the bottom of the Rhine River. We see three Rhine maidens swimming around. They guard the gold. And all is fine with the world, says Fred, while the gold stays there.
That's the fundamental thing of the Ring cycle. When it's stolen, theft, and it's given away like taxes to the rich, what happens is everything goes askew. Mm. And therefore, we try to put the gold back in the Rhine. It takes 20 hours to do it.
But for the moment, what we see on stage are Rhine maidens swimming, shimmering gold. And what we hear is the orchestra building around one E-flat chord. And this is where things get interesting. As John Mahler tells his class, this may be more than just pretty water music.
In one sense, the opening of the prelude is showing you the Rhine River. From the very depths of the Rhine, when you get the opening E-flat in the double basses, then to higher levels and more activity with arpeggio figures in the strings. But on a much deeper level, Wagner's giving you creation itself. And he represents this by using the overtone series. In other words, we have, in a sense, the creation of tone from one pitch.
The birth of an entire universe, as told in music, note by note, atom by atom. Which is why Professor Mahler tells his students, when they're in the audience during this scene, they may want to close their eyes.
It's going to burst out after more than 3 minutes, and you get the first Rhine maiden entering, Voglinda. And initially she sings a couple of nonsense syllables until she actually starts to speak the words of the opera. So it's as if Wagner is also trying to convey the creation of speech.
This is just one indication that Wagner's approach to drama is pretty wild. On stage, the eyes in our head are seeing Rhine maidens swimming, while the eyes in our ears are getting another image of the cosmos being born. And perhaps Wagner meant for our mind to somehow blend the two. The question remains, though, how do you even get the first part right? The visuals. This is opera, remember, so along with music, we've got the problem of staging.
The Ring is the biggest project, I think, that any opera house faces, always.
This is Joe Clark, the Metropolitan Opera's technical director, and we're on stage during a changeover.
There's a challenge there that I don't think is like anything else.
To our right, 4,000 empty seats. To our left, 60-some-odd workers swing hammers and push props. And to my dismay, for the swimming Rhine maiden scene, he says they don't use an aquarium.
It's certainly not realistic water by any means. In fact, it's very stylized, but the whole proscenium is filled with a number of moving gauzes that are painted to look like water. They're constantly in motion, and there are smoke and dry ice effects operating at the same time with fans. So again, it sort of seems like currents underwater.
And the three Rhine maidens, meanwhile, Joe has them stand on three separate stage lifts, which move up and down.
But very slowly, so you get that sense of water flowing.
So, three scenes.
Mm.
Three scenes, three different locations,
right.
And the music carries you along through in a very smooth way, but I don't think things ever go that smoothly in your editing room. Can you give us a sense of how you worked with the music to tie those three very different scenes together?
Well, the music you just heard is all the opening segment to the first opera, and it's this wonderful sort of watery kind of music that builds from nothing and then becomes this sort of like waves of sound cascading in on itself and building. And it's it was just a natural choice for us to use that as a way of introducing people to the world of Wagnerian opera, specifically the first opera. As to how we make those choices, it's about pacing, and also my primary objective here was to make this thing live in the world. And so it's why we go to Fairway. It's why we're always going to different places. This is a work that was written a very long time ago, but it still has contemporary resonance. And so the choice to go shopping with this guy who cooks a meal for the ring cycle was natural, because it's unfolding before your eyes. It's action, it's plot, it's all the things we want from radio and that sometimes we don't get when we're doing these historical pieces.
Jad Abumrad produced The Ring and I, along with Aaron Cohen and Elena Park. This piece won an honorable mention at the Third Coast Festival. Some music has the power to take over people's lives, but this next piece tells the story of music designed to stay in the background, from Erik Satie to Brian Eno to Muzak. The Wire is an 8-part series for the CBC about the impact of electricity on music. It was produced by Paolo Pietropaolo, Joey Taylor, and Chris Brooks. Every year, the Third Coast Festival staff gives an award for a program it particularly loves. And this time, the director's choice went to episode 5 of The Wire, The Sound Around. Originally, the producers wanted to find a way to get more electronic music on the air. They decided a way to do it was to produce a series about all the ways that electricity has changed music. Here's Paolo Pietropaolo and Joey Taylor.
Once we determined that, we realized, well, gee, if it's electricity, what about the electric guitar? What about electric recording? What about electric microphones?
It was great fun to do that, to go through and pick the technologies and to think about the people that we could talk to from those technologies, who would represent, who would we like to speak to. And we didn't want it to be a straight-up documentary.
We didn't want to teach anybody anything.
Exactly. We don't want to be teachers.
Yeah.
We want to be sharers.
And enthusiasts.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us to episode 5, background music, the ubiquity of music. And it starts with a sound montage, which is, it sounds a little, this is an overused word, mashup, but it does sound like a mashup of many of the sound elements and the themes of the whole piece.
What we notice, if we notice it at all, is the kind of soundtrack that's played at a restaurant, for example, where it becomes sort of oral wallpaper. And there's nothing you can do about it.
How do we perceive?
Music is always there in your environment. It means that there's a very, very different relationship to music. It's not so focused, it's maybe not so special in a way.
You know, there's a term, elevator music.
The recording technologies have been able to take music outside of the specific time and place that it's created in. And I think that's been a huge change in our way of thinking about music.
Electricity tends to just make everything become everywhere.
How do we perceive?
Wondering, well, what's going on in your ears?
How do we perceive?
Ambient music.
Somehow I think that affects how we perceive sounds.
Silences.
Muzak's relationship with silence. We're a music company. We're an imaging company. We're an audio branding company. Our company's not about silence.
How do we perceive?
Unpleasant silences.
How do we perceive?
Ambient music.
I have to describe for our audience how both of you are listening to this. You're grooving to the music. Joey's hand is playing, I think, the keyboards along with it. You're moving to the beat of how do we perceive? So tell me, how did that come together, using this motif? This is a recurring motif, mm-hmm. especially this syncopated rhythm that you create with the language, the words.
That was part of our objective, was to take a motif for every episode and make it recur.
Compose it.
Compose each episode like a long-form piece of music.
On a really different tack, on a journalistic tack, it makes sense you'd have a segment on Muzak, of course. We're talking about ambient background music. But Muzak could be a hard thing to say something new and fresh and interesting about. I mean, a lot has been written about it. We've all experienced it all around us. So what were your standards? It's always a question, you know, what's assumed common knowledge and what's a new take?
Personally, I found the Muzak segment totally fascinating because I'm not sure, I think people still, I mean, in fact, even Mark Kingwell said in his interview segment about Muzak, well, you know, it's this American songbook stuff and it's, you know, whatever. It's like,
no, not anymore.
Not anymore. You go to that Muzak website, it's very hip, it's very cool, and they are about audio branding and audio architecture and all the stuff that is not part of the cliche that people have in their mind about Muzak.
You say in the piece to introduce it, it's like entering the future when you bring up their website.
Yeah.
Why don't we listen to some of this? To this segment on Muzak.
My name is Kenny Kahn. I'm the Senior Vice President of Product and Marketing for Muzak. This year is the 70th anniversary of the company Muzak, which was formed by General George Owen Squire. He was a huge music fan and an entrepreneur in his own right and wanted to start a business. And during World War I, he piped live music into typing pools where there were teams of women typing the same letter over and over again, and they had a difficult time staying motivated. And his feeling was if he put live music, the live music of the day, into their typing pools, that it would keep them motivated, and it did, and that was kind of the beginning of Muzak. There's a term, elevator music, that's tagged to Muzak, and it's actually an interesting story. As buildings started to be built, this funny little device called an elevator went in, and people were nervous to get into this little box that was held by a cable, and Squire had the idea that if he put in the modern music of the day, the Jimmy and Tommy Dorseys of the day, into the elevator, that it could calm people's fears, and it did. Moving forward, the company started to put music into businesses all across the country. In 1984, Muzak introduced a program called Foreground Music One, which was popular contemporary music of the day, and it was the original artist. And today the company produces literally thousands of programs that are customized for the biggest businesses and brands on the planet. Muzak is in over 400,000 businesses across the United States and throughout Canada.
What was wrong with silence? What's the need to put music in all spaces?
How do we perceive?
Unpleasant silence.
We're a music company. Our company is not about silence.
Oh, see, that's the payoff, right?
There's the silence.
Yeah.
Did you get to hold it as long as you wanted to?
Yeah.
Was that just right?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I almost said something.
In the silence.
We actually had this wonderful moment when we were talking about how long to hold that first silence.
Yes.
That in a way the silence becomes a note in the piece. We debated how long can we push that moment of silence before master control for the CBC network kicks in and says, uh-oh, dead air.
Yeah, and we wanted to push it.
We wanted to really push it.
Get as close as you can.
And that whole thing about uncomfortable silences had a real meaning in broadcast terms, too. What's an uncomfortable silence in terms of a broadcaster? How much silence can you have on the radio before someone assumes that something's gone horribly wrong?
Well, what have you and your colleague Chris Brooks, do you think, learned about listening through doing this episode, this series?
Well, I think the more I think about it, actually, it was a really bold thing to actually even propose this show this way.
Yeah.
Because we were, I think, expressing our own ideas about listening, which don't get a lot of exercise on the public space in radio. And so I think we were exploring our own sense of what constituted, you know, deep listening. And then to do that, get to do that in public and drag a whole bunch of people along with you, that's pretty cool.
Joey Taylor and Paolo Pietro Paolo, along with Chris Brooks, produced the CBC series The Wire. It won the Director's Choice Award at the Third Coast Festival. And this is the 2005 Third Coast Festival broadcast. I'm Barbara Bogave. This program is produced by Ben Shapiro for Chicago Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. To learn more about the festival and to hear more of the winning entries, check out thirdcoastfestival.org. The executive director of the festival is Johanna Zorn. The managing director is Julie Shapiro. The festival producer is Roman Mars, and the festival assistant is Callie Carswell. The Third Coast International Audio Festival is made possible with lead support from the Richard H. Driehaus Foundation and major funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide. It's made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts. There are holiday classics ahead as the School of Music presents its annual carol concert. The Champaign-Urbana Ballet and Sinfonia de Camera present the Nutcracker, and Chicago's Apollo Chorus joins the Champaign-Urbana Symphony for Handel's